Let's go back a little bit. I want to ask you a few questions about Queenie and writing and publishing and editing. You have been with Simon & Schuster for how many years?
26 years.
I guess you give lie to the assumption that there's a terrible turnover in publishing. Huh?
Well, there tends to be a high turnover in publishing, as a matter of fact, or there certainly does these days. But I would say that my career proves that that is not necessarily the rule.
Why is there such a high turnover in publishing?
I think largely because there are two different phenomena involved here. One is the general collapse of education in the United States today, which means that we are turning out fewer and fewer people who are, in fact, interested in books or capable of doing anything with them. The second is that those people who are interested in books, stories, and have the ability to do something with that can make money far more quickly by going into television or the motion picture business, where you can luck out, or luck in, rather, and suddenly make a great deal of money. I mean, Beverly Hills is full of people who at the age of 25 or 26 have lucked into something and made a couple of $1 million and are driving around in Mercedes. That doesn't happen to you in publishing. There's a long, arduous apprenticeship. And from that point of view, it represents a radically more difficult and, I think, demanding choice of profession than a lot of others.
You hire editors, don't you, as editor-in-chief?
I participate in that decision, yes.
Well, yeah, yes. All right. What do you look, who do you look upon? What sort of person do you look upon as someone that you would hire as an editor?
Well, I'm probably a poor example of how to do it, to tell you the truth, because the only way I know how to hire a good editor is to go out and hire somebody who's already a good editor from someone else.
You don't start from scratch.
Unfortunately, we do that too, and we've done a lot of that too, but it seldom seems to work out. I'm a living contradiction to that rule, because I worked out, but generally speaking, it's safer to hire somebody who's already playing in the big league somewhere else.
You did indeed work out. How did you ever get into publishing? That was something that probably didn't enter your mind as you were growing up, did it?
Certainly not, no. As a matter of fact, I always assumed in a vague kind of way that the courted dynasty would go on forever and that I'd fall into it. And then when my uncle Alexander Korda, the motion picture producer, died in 1956, I suddenly faced the fact that there wasn't going to be a family business for me to drop into, and I came over to this country from England where I'd been living, and
How old were you at that time?
I would have been in my 20s, and actually worked here at CBS for a while. I was in the story department of Playhouse 90, and one day an executive who'd been appointed to Playhouse 90 came in and said that it was his task to brush out the cobwebs and put an end to that kind of programming. And even then I was intelligent enough to know that down at the bottom of the pyramid I would be one of the first cobwebs to be brushed. And looked around for another job, and somebody suggested book publishing, which I didn't know very much about, but I like reading books.
CBS, incidentally, has always made good decisions.
Well, they may have made a wise decision in my case. I'm not so sure that they made a wise decision in the case of Playhouse 90. They obviously did make a wise decision, but the truth of the matter is what is being done in color on television as series, miniseries, now is exactly what Playhouse 90 was doing. The wheel turns, but the truth of the matter is that the more it turns, the more it produces the same thing.
So you landed a job at Simon & Schuster?
So I landed a job at Simon & Schuster as an assistant editor. And
what does an assistant editor do?
Well, in my case, I read. And
but didn't actually edit?
Oh, no, I started off editing right away. In those days, there was a tremendous amount of work to be done, very few people to do it, and I was lucky in that respect. So, again, one of the differences in the profession today is if you came to a major publishing house, that everybody treats it as if it were flying a Boeing 747. I mean, you know, they're not going to let you pick up a pencil for two or three years. But when I came into book publishing, it was a small, tightly knit, privately owned business, and you arrived in the front door and somebody handed you a stack of manuscripts and a pencil and said, for Christ's sake, get going on these. Big difference.
Mm-hmm. 26 years with the same company. That is not only unusual for publishing, I think it's unusual for just about any industry, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there are people who have done murder one and not served 26 years. It's a long time.
But it must be an exciting job for you to stay in it as long as you have.
It's gotten better in the past 10 years. The first 10 years were kind of a drag. A lot of work, very low pay, no public visibility, and a business which didn't seem to be going anywhere in particular except where it had been for the past 200 or 300 years since Gutenberg. People knock big corporations, conglomerates, and so forth, but the truth of the matter is that until the big corporations took notice of publishing and began to pour some capital into the business, and until the small family-owned businesses gave way to businesses that really had to make a living by themselves and turn a profit, the good things that have taken place in publishing, both for the authors and the people who work in it, did not happen.
Queenie, your book, you wrote it, your editor-in-chief, Simon & Schuster. This is published by London Press, which is an imprint of Simon & Schuster. Is there any conflict or potential? Well, I won't say there. I won't ask. Is there any potential conflict having a book published by someone as high up as you in the company by, in effect, the same company?
Well, London is an independent entity within Simon & Schuster, run by Joni Evans, and that is very important to me, both because Joni's a wonderful editor, but also because I don't want to sit in on meetings where my own book is discussed. The embarrassment potential is more severe than the conflict, actually.
But she's also the wife of your boss.
Well, that's not really a conflict, but even if it were a conflict, it wouldn't be a conflict for me. Mm-hmm. That's a potential conflict for Joni, but certainly not mm-hmm. for me. But it enables me to be published by Simon & Schuster, which I do feel very strongly about, because it's like playing on the home team. And at the same time, not be directly involved in the publishing of the book, which is also very important, because I can't possibly wear both hats for my same book. There's another aspect to it. I could have continued to be published by Random House, which published 5 of my books very successfully. One of them, Power, was a number one bestseller, after all. But if you take the present, I'm on a book tour now, which is likely to go on for another 2 weeks. It's been going on for 3 weeks, so I will be out of the office really for 5 weeks touring for Queenie, traveling around the United States. If I were published by Random House or another publisher, I think Simon & Schuster would have a legitimate grievance against me for not being, as it were, on deck running the ship. As matters stand, I am, after all, if the book works, making money for Simon & Schuster in a different way. And I feel, therefore, less of a conflict and less of a sense of guilt at not being there than I would if I were touring for another house, in addition to which I'm avoiding, very obviously, the corporate problem of somebody pointing a finger at me and saying, hey, wait a minute, how can you be out there on the road selling Queenie for X, Y, or Z when you should be home working for us?
Of course, that's the key. Simon & Schuster expects Queenie to make a good deal of money, and if they thought it wouldn't make a good deal of money, I don't suppose you'd be publishing there, would you?
Yeah, well, that was never an issue with Queenie. We all expected Queenie. Now, mind you can be wrong in having those expectations, but we always expected Queenie to make money. No. And, in fact, Simon & Schuster and Random House both offered me the same advance. I said that I would not bargain between them, that I wanted X number of dollars, a number in the high six figures, and that was what I wanted for the book. But that I would not bargain between the two houses. I would have to make up my mind on which house would publish me, divorced entirely from the question of money.
Michael Korda, editor-in-chief at Simon & Schuster, also a writer. Does a writer who is an editor need an editor?
Certainly I do, and I think almost everybody is better off with a good editor. I rely very strongly on Joni Evans, who is my editor, not just for correction, course correction, as it were, and not just for telling me when I'm indulging myself. Dr. Samuel Johnson, actually said it all about editing when he said, and I quote, in the 18th century, when you have written a passage that seems to you particularly fine, strike it out.
Mm-hmm.
And there is nobody who does not benefit from what I call the emperor's new clothes question, which is to say, yes, this is all very well, but do you really need it, and what's it doing here? In addition to that, though, a good editor is a combination of psychologist, psychoanalyst, father or mother confessor, and cheerleader. It's a lonely, arduous, and long business to write a book, irrespective of whether the book is a good book or a bad book or a successful book or an unsuccessful book. And you need somebody who genuinely believes in the book. It's not enough to say your wife or your children believe in it, because you know that, of course, subjectively they have to believe in it. You need somebody who has actually got, as it were, bucks on the line behind it, who believes in it and believes in you. And that's one of the most important things that an editor can provide, is that kind of enthusiasm.
I was talking to a highly regarded writer of small books of a type that would not be published by Simon & Schuster, whose original editor some years ago was Cork Smith. This writer now has a different editor, who is a young editor, maybe an assistant editor, a young person in his early 20s, income around $11,000 a year, somewhat intimidated by this writer, and the writer, as a result, feels that he's been abandoned, he's been left, the young editor doesn't give him any guidance, any help. I just wonder, is it possible for a writer to intimidate an editor so that the writer gets his way? Does this happen often?
Oh, I think it happens very often. I don't think it would happen with me as an editor. After 26 years, I'm not likely to be intimidated by anybody. And I'm not sure that I would have been intimidated by anybody 26 years ago either. But it certainly can happen. It's a question of personality. I think that to be a good editor, you need to have a cheerful, optimistic, but nevertheless realistic and forceful personality, and not let yourself be bullied into accepting work that you know is inferior, in the sense that it is below the level of acceptability of the writer in question. That is not a watermark line, as it were. The level of acceptability for one person is not necessarily the level of acceptability for another. But what you must ensure is that your writers are producing their best work. It's in their interest to do it.
I have a feeling that James Jones somehow intimidated his editors. I've read most of his material, and I noticed that his books in later years became bigger and bigger and thicker and more redundant, and I thought, couldn't a good editor have made slashed that copy?
Yeah, with all due respect, though, that's not a question of intimidation, that's a question of clout. At a certain point in time, writers who reach a stage of enormous success, after all, become very difficult to edit unless they absolutely trust their editors. I hope most of mine do. But certainly when they move to a new publishing house, they have the ultimate clout of being able to say, if you don't leave me alone, I'm going to move again. And that's, with the case of somebody who's a number one bestseller, a sizable amount of clout. The point there is that you've got to make the author trust you and realize that it isn't an adversarial relationship, that it's a cooperative relationship, that I'm not being critical because I'm a critical personality, that on the whole, I'd rather not go to the bother of reading a book 15 times over and editing and cutting it. I'd rather just give it to the printer and let it go. It's again, a question of relationship and personality that really determines the editorial relationship with the author.
Michael Korda, Queenie, in writing Queenie, you drew on your family background quite a bit, didn't you?
I mind it, I think, would be a fairer comment. Yes, I mind it for Charmed Lives, which was a biography of my family. And I left my aunt, Merle Oberon, out of Charmed Lives in large measure because she was to some degree peripheral to the story, and also because she cut me out of her will and threatened to sue me for libel for mentioning in the book that she had been born originally Queenie Estelle O'Brien Thompson in Bombay, as opposed to having been born in Tasmania of Anglo-Irish parents. Merle was, in fact, Eurasian, or half-caste, if either of those two words can be used today, and had invested a large part of her life in burying the reality of her birth and childhood, and in further buttressing this legendary figure whom she had created as Merle Oberon. Merle Oberon's major work of art was Merle Oberon, not her movies. And while I was very fond of her, and we were at many periods of our lives quite close, very close, I never saw anything particularly wrong in saying that Merle had been born Queenie. I thought that her story was more moving, more affecting, and in many ways more exciting, the real story, as opposed to the invented story, which I thought was, relatively speaking, duller. Also, when I was a child, I grew up around Merle Oberon and my Uncle Alex when they were married, and my mother had been a dancer in the chorus line at the Café de Paris in London, a famous nightclub of the late 1920s and early 1930s, when Merle had been a hostess in the same establishment. And so when I was a child, Merle was still in the larval or transitional phase between Queenie and Merle Oberon. And I knew plenty of people when I was a child, including my mother, who had known Merle as Queenie, and also plenty of people, including my nanny, who knew that Merle was Eurasian. So I was able to witness the transformation of Queenie into Merle from very close up, as it were. And by the time I was a young adult, as they now say, or a teenager, that transformation was essentially completed, and Merle had managed to manufacture herself all over again in a different mold. I remember many years ago visiting her in California after we'd been separated for some time. She'd divorced my uncle Alexander Korda, and I had gone to live in Europe to go to school there. And I remember going to Merle's house in Malibu, and over the fireplace of this beautiful house was a magnificent oil painting of a very, very beautiful woman. Very pale-skinned, aristocratic face. Eyes rather like Merle's, in a very expensive and elaborate evening gown with quite expensive jewelry on it. Magnificent paintings above the fireplace, and I'm waiting for Merle to come down. And I turned to the housekeeper, and I said, who is the lady in the painting? And the housekeeper stares at me and sighs and says, Miss Oberon says it's her mother. Well, the truth of the matter is that Merle's mother was, in fact, a rather plucky and courageous woman named Ma Thompson, who ran a boarding house of disreputable reputation in Bombay, and was, not to be unkind, very dark, and probably never owned any jewels or evening gowns in her life. And in fact, Merle, in later life, when she moved to Acapulco and her mother was very ill in India, brought her mother over to live with her in Acapulco, which I think was a very generous gesture and a rather courageous one in the circumstances, but dressed her mother up as the maid. And people in the know used to say how cruel it was of Merle Oberon to have her mother in the house working as a maid. But the fact of the matter was, it was typical of Merle in that she wanted to have her cake and eat it too. She had a good impulse to bring her mother over to live in comfort for the rest of her days in Acapulco instead of in squalor in India. And that's much to Merle's credit. On the other hand, having invested 20 or 30 years in the legend of having been born in Tasmania of an Anglo-French mother, it would have been rather difficult to explain Ma Thompson, with her comparatively dark face, as her mother, or to introduce her and say, this is my mother. So she dressed her up as the maid and thus was able to have her cake and eat it too. But you observe that at close quarters, and it gradually begins to turn your mind to a couple of very interesting questions, which is what the novel Queenie is really about. The first question is, what is it like to self-invent yourself? Which is to say that early on, Merle decided on this person that she wanted to become and set out quite pragmatically to become that person, even though it meant ruthlessly eliminating every single hint or trace of her background in her childhood, and inventing, in fact, a whole new background in childhood, among other things. And I find that interesting because Merle succeeded in doing it triumphantly, and yet at the same time I always felt that there was a hollow at the center of her soul, at the center of her character, which is inevitable in people who self-invent themselves, because no matter how carefully you do it, first of all, you can never completely hide the past. It's always out there waiting to grab you, even when you're 60 or 70 years old, and gives you something to be frightened of all your life. And secondly, by creating this vacuum at the center of your being, you do, I think, irreparable damage to your personality and compromise your opportunities for happiness without even knowing that you've done it. So that it's one of those many areas of life in which success in fact engenders tragedy, and the more successful you are, the more tragic the circumstances are likely to be. The second is the effect on the personality of total, awesome, devastating, unique beauty. From the time she was 10 or 12, Merle was recognized as a great, great beauty. I still think today, if you look at pictures of Merle Oberon or Queenie, that there probably was no more beautiful woman in her time than Merle Oberon. And yet, what does that do to somebody? I'm not sure you see that the very beautiful ever can see or appreciate or feel their own beauty. They see it reflected in your eyes or mine. That's why, for example, even as a child, I remember Merle being unable to walk past a mirror without staring at it. It's not narcissism or vanity. It's panic and fear. It's the need to look into that mirror and try and find what it is there that makes her different, that makes you look at her. And, of course, the inability to really see it, because beauty is a responsibility and a burden. It fades. It's a problem. It makes you terrified. Accidents can happen, as happened to Merle and happens in the novel to Queenie. Age is something that you cannot put up forever. Your assets are visibly diminishing in front of your very eyes, and at the same time, they are assets that are, in a way, unknowable and untouchable. They're mysterious. So there's a potential here in Merle, which is what I wanted to reflect in writing the novel Queenie, for somebody to be triumphantly successful in every area of life that we really admire, rightly or wrongly, to become famous, to become wealthy, to be extravagantly and uniquely beautiful, to lead an enormously exciting social and sexual life, to have an outlet for one's passions and ambitions to a degree that is very, very unlikely for most people. And yet, at the same time, because of these two factors, the beauty and the self-invention of a new character, which one plays all one's life, because of these two factors, tragedy lies at the heart of that life, even when it is at its most dazzling and successful. And it struck me, it must have struck me many years ago, that if that wasn't the subject for a novel, and damned if I know what is.